You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, September 15th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, investigative reporter at the Washington Post, Craig Whitlock, on his latest book, The Afghanistan Papers, A Secret History of the War. Also on the program today, the recall fails miserably in California, as the California Republican Party in total shambles. In Washington, 17 Democrats now publicly committed to sinking the bipartisan infrastructure bill if it is not coupled with the Democratic reconciliation bill. Meanwhile, Senate and House Democrats clash over how to tax the rich. Mitch McConnell vows no Republican votes to raise the debt ceiling. And one in four hospitals in the south of this country at near ICU capacity amid Delta spikes. Haitian national prosecutor claims there's evidence linking the acting prime minister to the assassination of the late President Moise. Meanwhile, North and South Korea both test ballistic missiles. Book alleges that General Milley, the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, contacted China to assure them he was sitting on Trump post January 6th. New York lawmakers may use their supermajority to draw up to five Republican congressional seats into oblivion. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us on Hump Day. Here,
whoa,
as always, yes, I've adopted the kids' lingo, is Emma Vigeland. Hello, Emma.
Oh, poggers.
Yeah. Speaking of kids' lingo, I am in a, you know, I was going to say I'm in a good mood today, and I don't want to exaggerate, but... there were two things that made me happy as I'm reading off the headlines. One, I was very happy to see the numbers in California. I was happy with the way, and we will talk about this later in the show, with the way that it was being reported. I'll get to that in a second. Let me just start with this and what made me happy. And it was the last thing. It was like that New York state lawmakers, they now have a supermajority in New York state government, largely because of the but she was never the official governor, Cynthia Nixon.
No, but we call her that here.
We call her the governor because she forced the former governor Cuomo, which also makes me happy to say.
Oh, yes. Disgrace Governor Cuomo, ousted powerless Governor Cuomo.
All of those things. It's like a shower of joy on me. I'm not going to get into the specifics. But and so New York, because former Governor Nixon was able to get rid of the caucus that caucused with the Republicans. It was a Democratic caucus that was sort of functioning as a Republicans. Midwifed. The idea was midwifed by Cuomo.
The IDC.
Because now Democrats in New York State have control, they have the ability to ignore the commission that wants to redo the districts in a way that would not, that was nonpartisan. And while I would like to see a federal law that prevents political gerrymandering. Until we get that, it is ridiculous for states like New York and California not to take advantage of their opportunity to do what Texas and Florida has already done, to do what Wisconsin has already done, to do what Pennsylvania has already done, and gerrymander in a way that isn't favorable to their party. And now, you're not going to get to a place where you have, like in Wisconsin, where Democrats win 54% of the vote, and then Republicans, with that 46% of the vote that they garner across the state, end up having 65% of the elected state representatives. However, the idea that Democrats might get rid of five Republican seats in this state because of the gerrymandering, we're already losing one seat, but they're going to redistrict and essentially eliminate a total of five Republican congressional seats. Yes, please.
See ya.
More of that. And in California, Gavin Newsom won in, I don't know what else to say, in terms of, where I should say the recall was rejected in a landslide. And yesterday on the show, we played a clip from Joe Biden saying, you either vote for Gavin, you either vote against the recall or you vote for Donald Trump. I think this is a very, very effective message for the 22 midterms. Negative partisanship drives people to the polls, and Democrats, for the first time, and not even by their own making, have the ability to drive their voters out to vote against something, and that is the shadow president, Donald Trump. And here is Gavin Newsom, after having won a resounding victory in the recall, being completely rejected. Remember, there's a $300 million escapade by the Republicans, because you only need 12% of the voters to sign a petition, and they got extra time because of COVID by a judge, I think, who was appointed by Trump. I'm not quite sure. Yes. So here's Gavin Newsom.
And I think about just in the last, you know, few days, and the former president put out saying this election was rigged. Now, democracy is not a football. You don't throw it around. It's more like a, I don't know, antique vase. You could drop it and smash it in a million different pieces. And that's what we're capable of doing if we don't stand up to meet the moment and push back. I said this many, many times on the campaign trail. You know, we may have defeated Trump, but Trumpism is not dead in this country. The big lie, the January 6th insurrection, all the voting suppression efforts that are happening all across this country, what's happening, the assault on fundamental rights, constitutionally protected rights of women and girls. It's a remarkable moment in our nation's history.
Now, I got to say, I don't particularly like Gavin Newsom, and when he talks, it reminds me of that. But I am excited by the notion that the Democratic consultants, who I think probably largely could not politic themselves out of a wet paper bag, have gotten the message that negative partisanship works. You have already a completely turnkey midterm election strategy, and that is to run against Trump and
handed
Trumpism.
To you.
Totally handed. And the shocking thing is that they're actually not taking it and then dropping it.
Like one would with an antique vase.
Like an antique vase or a football. Like, yeah. I mean, come on, dude.
Yeah.
You know, like, you can't spend 5 minutes to come up with a better metaphor than
don't
that.
Don't fumble that vase.
Democracy's not a football.
We all know about these. We all have handled antique vases before.
That, yeah, exactly.
He must have been doing that at French Laundry.
Exactly.
Yeah, but I totally agree with you. I mean, for the sake of broadcasting, I disagree. I agree, because one, negative partisanship works, obviously, as you say, and two, Democrats didn't have this opportunity in 2008 for a variety of reasons or under Obama. One, because he said, we're moving forward, we're not looking backward, and we're not going to hold the Bush administration to account, which was outrageous. But two, because the Republican Party had like largely wanted him to go away, and he did go away. The issue now is that Trump is still the Republicans' president. They love him, and he doesn't want to go away, even though he's been deplatformed. So it's a gift for the Democrats, and they have to seize it. And Newsom effectively nationalized this race, as you say. He made it about Trumpism. He connected Larry Elder and the voter suppression propaganda to what the Republicans were doing to January 6th. And then that's how you get your base to show up in an off year when the party is in control of all of the executive branch and the House and the Senate.
Exactly. I mean, Texas should be a motivation for Democratic voters in every state. And you don't need to have the Fabergé egg of democracy to know that. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Craig Whitlock, investigative reporter at The Washington Post, on his recent book, The Afghanistan Papers, A Secret History of the War. One sponsor of the program today, one that, frankly, I use their products daily. Now that I think about it, I just came out of the bathroom. I don't want to get too detailed, but I've been washing my hands.
Oh.
Yeah, soap.
I thought this was a Hello Tushy.
No. In this day and age, folks are always looking for a way to use natural products. They are also using a way to look like how they can, basically just live sustainably. Well, Grove is the online marketplace that delivers healthy home, beauty, and personal care products directly to you. Takes the guesswork out of going green. Every product is guaranteed to be good for you, your family, your home, and the planet. Grove carries the brands you know and love, like Mrs. Myers. They also have their best-selling Grove-made products. I have, they have like the seedling tree-free paper towels. They have recycled toilet paper. They also have, you can buy bags of refills for their soap. I have a lot of Grove soap containers around the house. You can try the Grove laundry detergent dispenser, which I also have. You basically get refills that are in recyclable containers. It has an applicator bottle, so it like automatically pours the amount that you need. It cuts plastic waste by 80%. You can join over 2 million households who choose to shop sustainably at Grove. Plus, shipping is fast and free on your first order. I got to say, the laundry detergent thing is awesome. It comes in a narrow dispenser. You fill it up, you put the refills aside, and this thing has that thing, you know what I'm talking about? Where you tip it and it automatically pours into the front part how much you should be putting in your washing machine. Because I have on very many occasions either put too much too little or too much. And when you put too much, it sometimes shuts your washing machine off.
Your clothes are all sticky.
Exactly. Choosing products that are better for you and the planet has never been easier. For a limited time, when our listeners go to grove.com/majority, it's grove.com now, /majority, you will get to choose a free starter set with your first order. Go to grove.com/majority to get your exclusive offer. That's grove.com/majority. You will be glad you did, I promise you. Okay, want to welcome to the program Craig Whitlock, investigative reporter at The Washington Post, author of The Afghanistan Papers, A Secret History of the War. Craig, welcome to the program. I'm here with Emma Vigeland.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Doing great.
Doing
thanks.
Well,
how are you doing? Congratulations on the book.
Thanks very much. We planned for it originally to come out in time for the 20th anniversary of the war, but when Biden announced the troop withdrawal in the spring, we moved it up, and coincidentally, it came out just as U.S. troops were withdrawing from Afghanistan.
I mean, it is a fascinating, it's a fascinating read. It's really sort of, I have to say, I mean, professionally, I would cover the reports of the war, you know, starting in 2004. I was very in tune with what was at least being reported through the first 3 years of the war. And this is to see this stuff is it's a little bit disturbing on some level, like the how much information we did not know. I mean, I don't want to say it's like you're living a lie on some level, but they're really, I mean, it was an ongoing lie. Well, let's just start with something sort of remedial. Like, tell us the process in which you got a hold of these papers and what the papers are.
Yeah, so the Afghanistan papers are notes and transcripts of more than 400 interviews with people who played a role in the war. Most of them are American officials from all three presidential administrations, Obama, Bush, and Trump. These interviews were conducted by a little-known federal agency called the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan. And the interviews were carried out for what they called a lessons learned project to try and learn from our mistakes in Afghanistan. The Inspector General put out some public reports based on this, but they were really sanitized and watered down. And I wanted to find out what the actual interviews said. And so long story short, the Washington Post put in Freedom of Information Act requests with the Inspector General. We had to fight in court for them for 3 years. We finally obtained the raw notes and transcripts. And they show time after time after time, these really blunt and frank admissions of all these failures in Afghanistan. And as some of them said, you know, it's really much worse than you think. You know, we had a fundamental misunderstanding of Afghanistan. There were a number of ambassadors and generals who literally said we didn't know what we were doing. So this level of admission of failure really was never said in public to the American people. It was only in these interviews.
How long of a period of time were the interviews? I mean, I want to get into the substance of them, but the process of it is also sort of fascinating to me because they're. People were very frank, it appears anyways, maybe, you know, at least the ones that have been highlighted were very frank. So like what is the relationship between SIGNAR? This is the group of the Inspector General. What is their relationship with other entities in the government? A, how long of a period of time did they interview people? And how did lieutenant generals, you know, foreign officers, how did they have the confidence that, like, I can say this in this context?
Yeah, those are all good questions. So the Inspector General started this project around 2015. And you have to remember the timing's important because people assumed the war was coming to an end. You know, Obama had promised to withdraw all U.S. troops from Afghanistan by the end of his second term. So at that point, the assumption was the war was ending, at least the American involvement. So the Inspector General said, this is a good time to interview people while their memories are relatively fresh so we can learn from our mistakes in Afghanistan and not repeat them in the future. Of course, the war kept dragging on and the Inspector General has still been interviewing people, but that was the original context. But they did go back and they interviewed people who were involved from the start under Bush, under Obama, and a little bit under Trump. We're actually still fighting in court for more documents from the Inspector General. They've continued to do interviews. We think this should all be public information. You're right. These people, a lot, but not all of them, assumed they were speaking confidentially to the Inspector General. That agency was chartered by Congress to investigate fraud, waste, and abuse in Afghanistan. But this was a different project for them where they were just doing a policy review. And, you know, they're able to interview whoever they want. I mean, it's not like they even have subpoena power if they want to use it. So they have some teeth, but this was all voluntary for the most part, these interviews. And unfortunately, the Inspector General decided that it was more important to keep those private and not to make them public. Our argument in court was, you know, what these people are saying, these are people in charge of the war, and they're admitting all their failures and how bad things were. And this was, you know, this was stuff the American people not only deserve to know, but need to know.
And I imagine, well, I get a couple of questions just from that, too, is that I imagine some of these people were also like, this is the end of Obama's term. So maybe the implications for me are not as dramatic. But what was the point? What's the point of this exercise if it's kept private? Like, well, I mean, like what was their rationale of it? You know, we're going to keep this private. I mean, I guess presumably it all came out, like, everybody was like, we've done exactly the right thing. And, you know, there's, you know, then we can apply. But, like, why do this if at the end it's going to be private? Like, who would have access to it?
Well, so they did publish some public reports, the inspector general did, but they omitted all these astonishing quotations, right? They sanitized interviews and watered it down. So it was sort of these dry academic bureaucratic reports that they put out. But all the people they interviewed, they didn't name more than 90% of them. They, you know, all the inflammatory stuff they left out. And the only reason is the inspector general is just protecting his bureaucratic privileges. He's worried that people won't talk to him again if this stuff ends up in the Washington Post or in public. And, you know, whatever, that's his concern. But the law is clear. The law says this is public information. The public has a right to see this stuff. It wasn't classified. And, you know, this, and in some ways, it is like the Pentagon Papers. It was this history of how screwed up things were in Afghanistan and how the government lied to the public about it. And so that's why we pushed as hard as we did to obtain them and put them all online.
All right. Well, let's get into some of the substance of it. The first, I guess, I don't know, 60 days of the war. I just, we're going to assess this on the stated agenda of why one would go to war. Being agnostic for a moment at the prospect of whether we should have actually gone to war as opposed to sort of engage in some type of police, policing argument or just tried to apprehend Al-Qaeda as we would in a more sort of like a police fashion. But as far as, you know, you set out as an agenda to go to war, the first 60 days were successful, I guess, by the measure of if you wanted to get rid of the Taliban. And then it was almost like we've caught the dog who catches the car and is just sitting there stunned because their head is reeling from, you know, bouncing on the bumper. And there was no plan for day 61, it feels like.
Well, that's true. And although we had mostly caught the car, right? The one thing we hadn't caught was Osama bin Laden. But we had opportunities for that. We missed him at Tora Bora in December 2001. But you're right. Certainly within the first few months, the Taliban have been toppled from power. And more importantly, from the United States perspective, Al-Qaeda's leaders had been killed, captured, or had fled Afghanistan. They'd gone to Pakistan, Iran, other parts of the Middle East. So we had accomplished what the original objective was. But you're right, then it was the question of now what? And we didn't have a plan. The big paradox was Afghanistan was a devastated country at that point. I mean, it was just really, really flattened by decades of war. They had millions of refugees. There were real fears of a famine. And now, you know, the Taliban was gone. So they didn't have a government. So the United States had a responsibility to try and stabilize the country and try and help Afghanistan get back on its feet. The problem was President Bush, when he had run for office against Al Gore, he had promised he would not use the military in any quote unquote nation building campaigns. You know, he assailed Clinton for doing this in the Balkans and in Haiti and Somalia. So on one hand, he knows Afghanistan needs help, but he's publicly said we're not going to do nation building. So he immediately kind of boxed himself in and that made things much harder.
But my recollection, and maybe it's mistaken, but my recollection was that pivot was successfully made. Like, I mean, there was charges of like Iran he specifically said no nation building. Like that was one of the sort of like on the highlight reel of that campaign. But they turned around and did say like, you know, and this was also, over the course of that summer, we saw a lot of reports of the Taliban destroying Buddha statues. And I mean, there was a lot of reports I remember that summer just about Afghanistan prior to 9/11, maybe just coincidentally. It felt like they had made that pivot. But like, what, why didn't they? And from the book, we learned that Rumsfeld more or less was like, I think we're done. Let's go. And they didn't do that. What, like, why couldn't they make that, that determination there? Was it because Bin Laden had gotten away at Tora Bora?
Well, this, these are all really good questions, right, in hindsight. And there was one interview with a diplomat named Nicholas Burns. He was at the time U.S. ambassador to NATO. Biden's just nominated him to be ambassador to China. So he's a career diplomat. But he said, yeah, we never really asked these basic questions of how long are we going to stay? What do we need to accomplish before we can leave? And he's talking about the period 2003, 2004. So even a, 2-3 years into the war, he's saying just nobody bothered to ask that question. Things went on autopilot because so much attention was focused on Iraq. You know, very quickly after the war in Afghanistan started, the Bush administration thought it had achieved a military victory there. So they started immediately planning for Iraq. And the best example of this was this memo I obtained for the book. It was a memo Donald Rumsfeld had written 1 year into the war. So 2002, he talks about going to the Oval Office to see Bush. And he tells the president, sir, you know, I've got two generals in town. You might want to meet with them. One is General Tommy Franks, who is in charge of all military operations in the Middle East, including war plans for Iraq. The other general is a guy named Dan McNeil. And Bush responded to Rumsfeld. He said, well, yeah, Franks, I want to meet with him so we can talk about Iraq. But who's McNeil? And Rumsfeld said, sir, he's your war commander in Afghanistan. He's in charge of the war in Afghanistan. And Bush said, oh, well, I don't need to meet with him. Right. So here's a commander in chief. Not only is he not remembered the name of his general in charge of the war in Afghanistan, but when told by Rumsfeld about this, he just says, well, I don't need to meet with him. Why spend time on that? And to me, that kind of summed up where things were within a year of the war in Afghanistan starting.
That's, I mean,
as an unbelievable anecdote. I mean, and also just makes total sense when looking at how the United States positioned itself relative to Afghanistan. Like the withdrawal, if you're disinterested in the country because, you know, no resources really outside of opium, which I know we'll touch on a little bit. No resources that the Bush administration's, you know, that interested in. Just withdraw then, right? And then maybe try to target Bin Laden at another time. But doesn't it say so much about how the national security establishment views itself that, like, the status quo was to be occupation with no end in sight as resources and energy is turned towards Iraq?
I think that's a good point, but I think you're almost in a way using too much common sense in how you're framing it. I think it was just sheer incompetence in the beginning, that they really were just so focused on Iraq, they didn't have a plan for Afghanistan. As you know, in these lessons learned interviews I obtained from the inspector general, there was this 3-star general, Doug Lute, who is the war czar for Obama and Bush. And one of his quotes was, it's much worse than you think. And he wasn't kidding. I'll give you an example that on those early years, this General McNeil, the guy who Bush forgot his name, he said in his own interview that he said, we didn't have a campaign plan in Afghanistan. I was just told to go over and chase terrorists. Rumsfeld told me he wasn't going to send more troops, but he said we didn't have a strategy. And I thought maybe this was hyperbole, right? What general admits they don't have a strategy? But he's like, no, we didn't have one. We were just over there chasing terrorists, and I was told not to ask for any more troops. I thought maybe McNeil was exaggerating, but there was another interview with his successor, a British general named David Richards, who was in charge of U.S. and NATO troops for about 18 months during the Bush administration. And he said the same thing. He said, we didn't have a strategy. We had a lot of tactics, but we didn't have a proper strategy in laying out our ends, ways, and means of what we were trying to accomplish. So I was shocked when I read this because, you know, I've covered the military for a long time, but, you know, since when do you hear generals in charge of a war admit that they didn't have a strategy? They weren't saying a bad strategy or a misguided strategy. They just said, we didn't have one. I mean, that to me was, I'm still shocked by that.
Who, presumably, right? And I have to say, and maybe I'm a bad person. No, I'm not. I was happy to see that Rumsfeld was like having a what appears to be a nervous breakdown on some level during 2003 or 2002. I mean, I found it very depressing that he exited this this plane of existence without having what I thought was sufficient karmic accountability. But with that said, like, presumably it's like it's Rumsfeld's strategy to develop, right? I mean, or like, do if I come in as the general in charge of the entire theater in Afghanistan, and I hear, like, I look to Rumsfeld and he's like, yeah, no, just keep it up over there. Do I not say, like, I'm going to do a strategy? Like, I'm going to create the strategy? Like, I mean, where's that supposed to happen in the flow chart of this stuff?
Okay, so I'm going to explain that. But again, it's much worse than you think, even your sense of it. So the chain of command is the general in charge of Afghanistan goes up his chain of command at the Pentagon, which goes to Rumsfeld, right? But then Rumsfeld answers to the commander in chief, which is Bush. So yes, Rumsfeld is responsible, but ultimately the president's responsible, right? You can't let him off the hook and just say it was Rumsfeld's job. Bush, who didn't even know his general's name, he's the one who's responsible for a strategy in Afghanistan, or at least ordering his subordinates, whether civilian in the form of Rumsfeld or the generals, to come up with one. But if you, as you point out, what if you're in the general's shoes, right? So the general who served immediately after McNeil was a guy named David Barno. He was a three-star general. And as he goes over there in 2003, he recognizes that the Taliban's starting to come back, that an insurgency is starting to build. So he's like, well, we got to come up with a strategy to deal with an insurgency. This isn't just hunting terrorists and Al-Qaeda. What are we going to do about this insurgency? But the army had not conducted counterinsurgency operations since Vietnam, and they had really lost all their experience with a with an insurgency. So Barno tells this story in this other interview for the book, in which he remembered taking a course on counterinsurgency when he was in West Point in the early 70s. And so he called up, he ordered some of the books, the textbooks he had used in the early 70s at West Point, so that he could come up with a counterinsurgency strategy. They literally were ordering books online to get shipped to Afghanistan so they could consult these old textbooks to come up with a strategy. So, like I said, it's worse than you think. The generals were trying, but this is how they were flailing around trying to decide what to do.
And one of the things that I learned from the book was that the counterinsurgency, to the extent and the counterterrorism, essentially was like the catalyst for regenerating the Taliban in many respects. That there was there had been so much fighting over the centuries in that country, that there had already been almost like a developed sense of how you end conflict, which was, we actually have sort of like a reconciliation, and we just sort of divvy stuff up at that point. And Karzai early on was like, let's bring the Taliban in and let's do this. And we would have none of it. So we didn't just not have a strategy. We were actively rejecting strategies that were coming essentially from the Afghans.
That's right. Early on, that was really the original sin in many ways, was after we thought the Taliban had been defeated militarily in November and December of 2001, the United Nations and the United States hosted this conference in Bonn, Germany, where all the factions from Afghanistan were invited, the warlords, the Northern Alliance, representatives of their former king. They needed to come up with a new political system. It was a recognition they'd have to write a new constitution. So they invited all these factions in Afghanistan that had been fighting each other for a long time, except for the Taliban. And in retrospect, of course, some Taliban members had expressed a willingness to come in from the cold and be part of the system, even though they had been defeated. And that's the point when the U.S. and its Afghan allies had the most leverage. It made the most sense to try and bring them in. I don't want to overstate it. It would have been difficult politically because back then, remember, you know, there was such a reaction after September 11th, such the public, by and large, the United States supported the war in Afghanistan. They wanted to go after al-Qaeda. The problem was the Bush administration kept lumping the Taliban and al-Qaeda together, calling them all terrorists. Rumsfeld and Bush both said the Taliban have two choices. They can surrender or die. We're not going to negotiate with terrorists. But that was the original sin. They should have, at that point, if they were smart, brought the Taliban into the fold somehow. Al-Qaeda was a different animal. Those were foreign fighters from Arab countries. But the Taliban was part of the fabric of Afghanistan. They weren't just going to erase them. And that's what led to the insurgency.
This is a little bit tangential, but I had wanted to ask you this question. There have been research done on the computer files that they found in Pakistan that Osama bin Laden had. And what has come out of that, broadly speaking, has been like Osama bin Laden never assumed that we would attack Afghanistan. Is that your understanding? I mean, I find that very hard to believe, basically because I remember maybe it was a month or 3 or 4 weeks before 9/11 that the leader of the Northern Alliance, the most successful sort of military commander of the Northern Alliance, it's sort of a loose configuration, had been assassinated. I think if I remember correctly, it was a fake interview and there was a bomb in what was ostensibly the video camera. It seemed to me always that they had done that. They had done that because they wanted to get rid of the most effective North Alliance leader, because in the event that there was an invasion and they didn't want that guy to be on the playing field. What's your understanding of that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that's something that's evolved the more time it passes, and there's different schools of thought on that. I mean, the documents you mentioned have been obtained during the bin Laden raid. Another journalist, Peter Bergen of CNN, has a new book out, and he's sifted through those documents a lot. And he makes that argument that bin Laden didn't really want the U.S. to invade Afghanistan, that he didn't anticipate it. But it's also been reported for many years. I used to cover al-Qaeda as my full-time beat during the Bush years and part of the Obama administration. And after 9/11, starting in 2003, 2004, Osama bin Laden would put out these videos that made it sound like he had been trying to lure the superpower into Afghanistan, just like, you know, he hoped what would happen to the U.S. is what happened to the Russians, that it would bleed us dry, essentially. And it sounded good, right? But this is something I think historians are still going to debate about. What were bin Laden's intentions? What did he expect would happen after 9/11? Did he think the United States would send this large force to Afghanistan or not? You know, what were his aspirations at that point? I think that's something that's going to be debated for a long time. I kind of fall into the camp thinking, no, he was trying to provoke the United States to come to Afghanistan because, in retrospect, that turned out pretty well for al-Qaeda. I mean, their organization was really harmed and decimated, but if the purpose was to bankrupt the enemy, you did a pretty good job. There's one interview in the Afghanistan papers with a former Navy SEAL named Jeffrey Eggers, who served at the White House under Bush and Obama on the National Security Council. And he said that Osama bin Laden is probably doing tricks in his watery grave, knowing how much we've spent in Afghanistan, that if he knew we spent $1 trillion and lost all these lives, he'd be thrilled. So that's the school of thought I kind of agree with, that for bin Laden, this was the best possible outcome. And then if you look today, it's even more so because the Taliban's back in power, controls more of Afghanistan than they ever did. They're stronger than they ever were. So from bin Laden's perspective, this is probably the ideal outcome to 9/11.
I am in that camp, and plus, because Iraq, I mean, we had Spencer Ackerman on the other day. Like, I think there's a very good, I think he has a very good argument that the way that we reacted to 9/11 has led us, like, you know, the impact has been far greater than even just, you know, a 20-year war that we lost, essentially. I think bin Laden, in his wildest dreams, couldn't have imagined that it could have gone that well. I mean, it was, I think it was like one of those things, like, you know, I thought I was in the I thought I was playing the lottery where I could win $5,000 and I get a $5 million check. Like, who, you know, how could that happen? I mean, I really do think that if anything, it was a failure of imagination as to how well this thing went for him.
You're right. And I think there's a consensus on that, that from bin Laden's perspective or al-Qaeda's perspective, the idea that we would also go into Iraq on this enormously costly failed war, they couldn't have even dreamed that up. That was more than they could have hoped for.
I absolutely. Let's move forward. So in some way, the concept that the story you're telling is of a 20-year war that was really like a series of 21-year wars. Like we kept making the same mistakes over and over again because there was no plan at any point. You couldn't even come in to the war 5 years later and go, we're not going to do what was done before, because nothing was attempted before. So you couldn't even say we're going to learn from our mistakes, because we hadn't really done anything that was deliberate enough to assess that that was a failure. I mean, is that an accurate description?
I think sort of. I think they did think, particularly as time went on, that they had a strategy. So you remember when Obama came into office, he was going to revise his strategy because, you know, he had promised to get out of Iraq, but he also promised when he ran for president that he would fix Afghanistan. So he had this strategy review, and the idea was, we need to devote more resources to Afghanistan than Bush did. We're going to come up with a new strategy, a more intensive counterinsurgency plan, where we'd send a total of 100,000 troops to Afghanistan, and we would essentially flood the country with money to try and rebuild it, to build public support for the Afghan government. So I think they sort of acknowledged what they had been doing wasn't working, but it wasn't like the new strategy was, you know, it certainly wasn't effective. I was going to say it wasn't well thought out, but they did spend a lot of time thinking about it. But in documents we obtained for the book, again, even then, there's some remarkable look backs at what happened. You might remember the general was named Stanley McChrystal. He was the commander under Obama of this surge of troops. And he had done a strategy review. He published a 60 or 70 page report that was classified at first, who was leaked to the Washington Post, in which he was calling for extra troops in this counterinsurgency strategy. But in interviews for my book, there were NATO officials and others who said that his strategy was really flawed on a number of counts. First of all, they couldn't even agree if it was a war or not, because a lot of our NATO allies were sending troops to Afghanistan on what they thought was a peacekeeping mission. But yet McChrystal was like, no, this is a war. But the document applied to all our NATO allies. So they had to go back to the lawyers, say, what do we do? If we call it a war, then maybe the Germans can't keep their troops there. So they added a phrase calling it's not a war in the conventional sense, just to get it past the lawyers. But again, you think about it, they can't even agree not only what we're trying to accomplish, but they can't even agree on whether it's a war or not. So this is the kind of just fundamental errors that in hindsight, you want to do a facepalm. You can't believe they were having debates over that stuff.
I think the movie Netflix made about the McChrystal time is War Inc., I think it is. And it was based at least in part on Michael Hastings' writing about the time that he spent with the McChrystal guys. And what you've just told us is a perfect example. I mean, the movie is a pretty good satire, and it's sort of like it's served up. That era.
Stranger than fiction, right? And that's the case here. That you think the movie is exaggerated, but the truth is actually worse.
It really is stunning. I want to just go back for a moment and tell the story, which came from the book, which I also didn't know, was how close Dick Cheney was to dying in that 07. Cheney went over there to visit. It was Bagram, I think. And there was a major suicide bombing That apparently, will you tell that story about it? Because this was also another thing that was not reported.
Yeah, so February 2007, Vice President Cheney makes an unannounced trip to the region. He first flies into Pakistan to talk with their military ruler, Pervez Musharraf, trying to get more help in the war. Then he slips into Afghanistan, first goes to Bagram Air Base, which is our biggest military installation. And it was reported time there was a suicide bomber outside the gates of Bagram, blew himself up. And the Taliban immediately, in public statements, said that the target was Cheney, you know, that we tried to kill the vice president. You know, he wasn't there, but that was the target. And at the time, the U.S. military countered in many public statements, and even the White House said this, that they dismissed this. They said Cheney was never in danger. Yes, he was at Bagram, but he was on the other end of this base. He was like a mile away. And they insisted there was no way the Taliban could have known his movements or where he was, and that this was just propaganda. But an interview I obtained for the Afghanistan papers, this was an oral history interview with an army officer who was in charge of security at Bagram. And he was working with the Secret Service to plan Cheney's movements. And he said, oh no, they came really close to getting Cheney, that the bomber attacked the front gate, blew himself up when he saw a line of SUVs coming out, and because it looked like a convoy for VIPs. And he thought it was Cheney, so he detonated his suicide bomb. In fact, that Cheney was supposed to come out 30 minutes later, right? So he said there's no question they knew where Cheney was. They knew this his movements. It was just we were lucky they blew himself up at the wrong time, but he only missed him by about 30 minutes. And not only is this important just to know what happened, how close of a call it was with Cheney, but this is an example of when the lies start to happen, right? The public deception in terms of what the U.S. military and White House were saying about what was going on in Afghanistan. The war was turning. The Taliban insurgency was growing more powerful. But yet the lies and deceptions from the top about what was going on really became ingrained at this point, that they would say one thing in public that they knew wasn't true. And that's what happened with the Cheney case. They served up a lie about how close it was to killing him.
Well, and it's also telling in the purpose of that lie is because A, it shows that the whole premise of Cheney's trip was a lie, that like we got locked down enough there that the vice president can drop in to the country. And then just the idea that you can't even secure that information that Cheney is on that base is indicative of just how leaky the entire enterprise was. That, I mean, it, you know, you haven't achieved, you're not controlling anywhere. If Cheney shows up on that airbase and they already know enough to have a suicide bomber there.
That's right. And that in ways was very, very significant because in 2007, it's important to sort of provide some context of how the war was going. The Taliban had within the past 2 years really escalated things, that they had been kind of a low level insurgency, but for the previous year, the number of suicide bombings had increased something like threefold. You know, the roadside bombs were really escalating that, you know, up till that point, the Taliban had kind of been limited in their geographic capacities. They were mostly along the border with Pakistan, but here they were carrying out a suicide bombing at the major U.S. military base in Bagram outside of Kabul. This was the first time they were able to pull something like that off. And the fact that they were able to target the vice president, whose visit had been unannounced, demonstrated exactly your point, which is that the Taliban was stronger than we had expected, but they also had good intelligence on the whereabouts of somebody like Cheney and could respond that quickly and send a suicide bomber there to try and get him.
The other, I think, important thing to note from your reporting and these interviews is the idea of when these, and I think it happened around 2007, but also stretched, it feels like, you know, even further into the Obama administration, that the suicide attacks were touted by our government as proof that these guys are really flailing now. This is like, this is a desperation move. And in fact, it turned out really, it was actually the opposite.
That's right. This is where it really gets into theater of the absurd. No matter what was going on, the U.S. government would always spin it as a positive development. And there was an interview with somebody who worked at the White House and the National Security Council under Obama, who said that this was all intentional, that they kept all these metrics or measurements of how things were going, and they would edit them essentially or distort them to always show, no matter what, that we were making progress. And this was a specific example cited by this White House official that said, you know, if the number of attacks on U.S. troops is going up, the explanation was, well, that's because we have more troops there. We're going on the offensive. And so there's more targets for the Taliban to shoot at. So it isn't a sign the Taliban's getting stronger. It's just there's more Americans for them to shoot at. And then the bombings would still go up. And they would say, well, with these suicide bombings, that shows the Taliban's desperate because they don't dare engage us in full-on battle on the battlefield. Well, of course they don't want to do that. This is a guerrilla war. This isn't some infantry formation out of World War II. But it just really is absurd the way that no matter when it was clear from the metrics that things were getting worse, they would twist them all around to say things were getting better.
And lastly, you know, I'm fascinated by Flynn. In 2015, Flynn is, I can't remember if he's like loosely associated with the McChrystal people on some of they've had some overlap. I mean, he is an intel guy, and he is considered, he's held in pretty high regard, I think, until around 2015. At one point, there's a break, and it's always been hard for me to tell. I mean, in retrospect, it seems a little clear that there was, you know, there wasn't just a break with Obama and the leadership, but there was a break with, you know, certain aspects of reality. And it's unclear when that happens with Flynn. But at least it appears that, like, you know, late into the Obama administration, he was like, this is a mess over here.
That's right. There's real irony, and I'm sort of fascinated by Michael Flynn, too, in this regard. When I covered the military, he was held in high esteem. He had been the intelligence chief in Afghanistan under McChrystal, and he was kind of seen as a hotshot at this point around 2010, 2011. He went on to become the director of the Defense Intelligence Agency under Obama, but he was pushed out around 2014, 2015. At that time is when he gave this long interview to the inspector general about what was going wrong in Afghanistan. And if you read or listen to that interview, which we had to go to court to obtain, you know, Finn's perceptions are pretty right on. He's on the mark in saying that, you know, we keep saying we're winning the war, but every time I go over there or you're on the ground, it's pretty clear we're losing. And he would explain all this machinations in the background of how the U.S. military just really wasn't looking at things with clear eyes. We ended up hearing about this interview he gave in 2016 because at that point he was campaigning with Trump. He had been forced to retire by Obama, and it was the summer of 2016 when he goes to the Republican National Convention and starts leading chants, lock her up, lock her up, later becomes Trump's national security advisor. And at that point, you know, his reputation really falls apart. And of course, today he associates with QAnon and other conspiracy theory groups. So his reputation has been transformed. But when he was in uniform, he was pretty highly regarded. And in this long interview he gave about Afghanistan back in 2015, he's on the mark about stuff.
Right. All right. So lastly, how is it, you know, I mean, the Afghanistan papers have been compared to the Vietnam papers. And it really feels like I mean, it's amazing to me that we were able to sort of just like sort of almost like just duplicate. I'm sorry, the Pentagon Papers to sort of duplicate this failure. Like, you know, with enough, if there's 20 years, there are 25 years in between, there's enough institutional memory or memory loss or societal memory loss that like you can do it again. I mean, that's the thing, is it feels like there's no there's no learning from. I mean, only Joe Biden seems to be the only person. And, you know, there's a story today that coming out of the new book from, I think it's Acosta and Woodward, that he basically, you know, rode over the generals and Blinken and just said, I'm getting out. But it's amazing to me that we could go through Vietnam and it was still pretty fresh in people's minds in the 90s, even, that we could do this again for 20 years.
Yeah, and looking back, again, it's in the category, it's worse than you think. You know, I went back and I found one of the first questions Bush was asked in October 2001, after he ordered the start of the war. He held this primetime news conference at the White House. One of the first questions he got was, you know, Mr. President, you know, how are we going to make sure we don't get bogged down like in Vietnam? Could Afghanistan turn into a quagmire? And Bush said, oh, no, we've learned our lessons from Vietnam. We're not going to let that happen. Right. So they were well aware of this. They knew the failures in Vietnam. They knew the mistakes the Russians made when they were in Afghanistan. And they would talk about this, Bush and Rumsfeld, in public. No, no, we've learned from those mistakes. We're not going to do the same thing. And at first, I think they did keep those lessons in the front of their minds. They were insistent on only sending a few troops to Afghanistan. They didn't want to send a bunch. They didn't want to be seen as occupiers. But over time, they stopped paying attention and the same thing happened, right? We got bogged down in Afghanistan very similarly to what happened in Vietnam. And we didn't learn from those lessons. And of course, as bad as that is in Afghanistan, you always worried the same thing could happen in 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now, when another crisis erupts somewhere around the world.
Greg Whitlock, the book is The Afghanistan Papers, Secret History of the War. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
You bet. Thanks for having me on.
All right, folks, quick break. We'll be back to wrap things up. Okay, folks, that is it for the free first half of our program.
Mm-hmm.
And for those of you who are watching on Peacock, we will see you tomorrow, or at least
I will see you.
Emma
tomorrow.
Will.
Sam is celebrating the holiday.
Yes, as we say, easy fast for those who are celebrating Yom Kippur. I will be fasting.
And oh, you will?
Of course.
Well,
and then I'll be back on Friday, having had atoned for my sins. So
there you go.
Yep.
Good for you.
If you're watching on Peacock, we'll see you on Friday. For the rest of you, good, Matt.
I was going to ask, do you have to atone for your shitlibness? But
yeah. Yeah. Of course. I've got a lot of apologies for Michael Tracy and Glenn Greenwald. Dave Rubin and Jimmy Dore.
I mean, you've got to atone for selling out your entire soul and your political philosophy to MSNBC.
That, I got to do that. I feel bad about putting Crowder in the hospital.
I feel bad about laughing about that Michael Tracy fan cam yesterday. So I'll be doing that on my own time as I'm not celebrating.
Yeah, you should do that. I don't even think I saw that. But folks, we're heading into the fun half of the program. And today on that fun half, we will indeed be taking phone calls, talking about all sorts of different things. Yep. And We will also go over some of the exit polling from the California recall, which I think is going to be important for 2022. We will talk a little bit about the reconciliation bill. There is there's a big argument between the Democrats in the House and in the Senate. The Senate is being more aggressive, actually, at least Wyden is,
yeah,
in terms of what they want, where they want the tax increases. My understanding is the Biden administration, well, we'll talk about this in the fun half, but my understanding is the Biden administration is really adamant that no one under, any earners under $400,000 a year, which is a significant amount of money,
yes,
in my estimation, be taxed, have a tax increase. And so, like, you know, I've been, you know, starting to bang on my drum. Not that anybody hears my drum, but bang on my drum.
So far,
the people who need to hear it aren't hearing it. But like, why aren't they running against the Trump tax cuts? And I think part of it is because they, for whatever reason, think like, oh, but then we'll get accused of raising money on people who are making less than $400,000. And it seems to me that you could just say like, well, yeah, but we're not going to. So we're running against the Trump tax cuts, but not all of them. But we're just saying that we're going against the Trump tax cuts because they were the least popular tax cuts in the history of tax cuts in this country.
Yeah, but they're all just like Reagan Democrats, scared of their own shadow. You can't talk
They don't like
about
to say
tax.
Trump. It's...
No, but they also don't like to talk about
but
tax cut repeals.
But we're raising taxes. I mean, like, we're going to do that. That's going to happen. But the big fight is on the stepped up basis on when you uninheritance taxes. We could talk about that in the fun half of the program. It is
it's just such fun stuff.
Yes. Well, that stuff is super fun. Also in the fun half, well, who knows what we're going to talk about. Part of that is going to be dictated to you, by you, because we have our phones are up at 646-257-3920. We have the IMs. You can IM the show by going to majorityapp.com. You load up the app on your phone, Android or iOS, and when you do, that gives us a backdoor into all of your information that we sell to an Israeli, that we outsource to an Israeli company, and we don't.
Yeah,
do
well, we know all the dirty things you look up.
Also, don't forget you can support this show, help it survive and thrive by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. It is our members who are our primary source of revenue. It is true that sometimes we get ads from YouTube, and sometimes we sell ads through our media broker, but our members remain our primary source of revenue, so you can help us out by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget AM Quickie. You can get it, an email blast in your email box every morning. Go to majority.fm, scroll down, and sign up, and we will never sell your email information. Also, check out Nomi Show, youtube.com, The Noma Key Show, and at, I don't know if they're going to be at twitch.tv this week because it's pre-recorded.
I don't know, yeah.
Matt, what is happening in the Matt Lekian Media Universe?
Tonight, 8 o'clock Eastern, 7 Central, Darna Noor is coming, joining us to talk about Entergy, the company that left nearly 800,000 without power in Louisiana, a union-led Green New Deal, and we'll also be talking about Bitcoin in El Salvador and why it's a big, you know, joke that's risking public money. Patreon.com/LeftReckoning. We passed 900 patrons. Thanks, everybody.
Nice!
Whoa.
I think it wasn't War Inc. is the name of that movie. I always get it confused. What was the name of the movie? It's on Netflix. It's a war movie, and it stars, what is it? War Machine. With Brad Pitt. Exactly.
Oh,
it's
right.
War Machine, not War Inc. War Machine. Sorry, folks.
I thought you might have meant War Dogs.
Nope.
I didn't see that. I heard bad things.
War Dogs?
It's okay.
It's okay.
It's based on Guy's book.
I just heard bad. I read
source material's better, of course.
He wasn't happy with the script, I think. I want to talk about that. All right, folks. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar! What a fucking nightmare!
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Denner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See, white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
Matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black African. And the alpha males are black. And the Africans are back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Alpha males are black. Africans are back.
Come on. Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am in total.
Pussy.